Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, supported by Cook, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. It's the middle of the heat wave as I'm writing this, so I'm thankful to my tap as it does chilled filtered water and chilled sparkling filtered water too. No bottled water for me, no spending money on that, first of all, and no wasting the plastic bottles they come in or the glass bottles. So, you know, as well as the 100 degree boiling hot water, you also get chilled water out of them too. Cooker is a great bit of kit. If you can afford one, I do recommend it. I just love mine. I think it's fantastic. For more information and to see the models, go to cooker.co.uk, which is Q-U-O-O-K-E-R, cooker.co.uk. I kind of like the black one they do. I've got sort of I don't know what you call it, brush steel or something, but they do a plat one as well now, which looks great. Cooker also support my new online show that comes out monthly. It's called Health, Fitness and Navigating Life. It's brand new. It's on YouTube. It's a nice, catchy title. I thought I'd tell you how it is. No messing about. The format is I talk to people in the public eye, generally people who are connected to the subjects about their lives and views on health, fitness and navigating life. The first episode, which is up now, is with Jason Fox. You'll know him from the Special Forces. He was in the SBS. He was also on SAS Who Dares Wins. He says fascinating things. He really does, actually. And he's funny. And he takes a mickey out of me a bit as well on there. So you'll enjoy that. I'll put the link up in the biograph bit, you know, the explanation bit of this podcast. But, you know, if you want to find it, just go to YouTube. Search for Health, Fitness and Navigating Life. Or my name, Tim Lovejoy. I'm sure that will come up. It's about 11 minutes long, something like that. It's not long. So I think you'll enjoy it. I'm trying to find the right duration for YouTube. Because it's good content. So you don't want to make it like 3 minutes long. But if you go too long, no one will watch it. I'm assuming it will keep people's attention. It moves quickly and it's quite colourful and it's got a very unique style to it, to say the least. I really love it. I love what we've done with it. But please let me know what you think as well. I really do appreciate feedback, as you know, even if it's negative. I don't like, Tim, you're an asshole sort of thing. Tim, you're just a wanker. I don't like that, but I don't mind. I prefer it if you did this, or I didn't like that bit. I don't mind that sort of stuff because, you know, I've been, you know, I could be wrong with some of the stuff I do. I've been wrong in the past. I know it sounds amazing. You probably don't believe it, but I have been wrong. Today's hour, I'm curious how to think about things differently in order to enhance our lives. This is a subject I love. I love looking at things and thinking, are we doing it right? Can we change it? I know my mates with this all the time. My obsessions are politics. I keep saying to them, 51 prime ministers, that's all. It's clearly not working, the political system at the moment, because I don't feel there's many people or anyone I want to vote for. So it seems to have broken. Maybe it's just a stage we're going through. And I wonder if we should change it. Well, education's another one. I talk about that constantly. Are we doing the right things with our children? Is it really? I mean, I did a documentary on this, God knows, 10, 15 years ago, where this bloke was explaining how the education system needed an overhaul. And we're still doing the same crap. Always energy. It just seems to me I'm sitting here in the boiling hot. There's so much energy coming off that big yellow thing in the sky. Surely we may be able to utilize that more. And the wind. And you know, all the other things. I don't know why we can't just press the button and just go for it. Thankfully, though, these are three, the politics, education, energy, the three of the subjects we're discussing today, hopefully with Mark Stevenson. Mark is a writer and a futurologist, the founder of League of Pragmatic Optimists. He's written for The Times, Guardian, Wall Street Journal, New Statesman, and more. By the way, I'm very opinionated on all these things. But I do change my mind a lot, and I can have my mind changed. It seems simple to me, but obviously, clearly it's not, because otherwise we'd just be doing it. Maybe it's fashion. Maybe we're going to move towards that soon. Anyway, listen, I first met Mark when he was a guest on Sunday Brunch, and he'd written a book called The Optimist Tour of the Future. What I liked about him was he wasn't taking the normal line of everything is bad, because it seems, you know, talking about fashionable, it seemed very fashionable take, where you can just sit there as an expert and go, just everything is so bad. Everything's, oh, you're, it's just so, everything is so, so bad. And it just kind of doesn't get us anywhere. I like people who are leading us in the right direction, telling us how we should be going, what we should be doing. You know, come on, let's find a way, let's navigate. You know, we understand things aren't working in all spheres of life, maybe, but some are. I mean, some things have changed dramatically and for the better. Anyway, he's achieved this optimism again in his latest book, We Do Things Differently, Stories from the Frontline of the Future. Let's find out all about him and his book. Let's meet him. Here's Mark. Hi, Mark. How are you?
I am busy. Can I swear on this one?
Yeah, of course you can.
Okay, I'm busy as fuck.
Why? What? There's just so much on?
Yeah, well, you know, obviously what I do is, you know, systems change consultancy on a broken world, and the world is increasingly broken and people are waking up and increasingly realizing that, and they keep phoning me up and saying, you know, all that stuff you've been banging on about for 20 years turns out to be true. Can you help, please?
Yeah, though, so, yeah, I would say that I want to get into a bit about you in a minute, but when I first met you, I just sort of said in my intro there that you weren't like everybody else who was just constantly saying the world is in everything is bad. You also had an eye looking at the positive bits of the future too. Are you still on that journey?
Well, yeah, you have to be. I mean, you know, if you can't believe the future can be better, then you're part of the problem. I'm not saying it will be, right? I mean, if we carry on the way we're going, it's not going to be. But you have to believe it can be. Otherwise, you're kind of condemning us to a disastrous future. So, you know, I'm a possibilist, really, which is like, you know, there is a possible brilliant future out there, and I know which side I'm on. I'm going to fight for it. And, you know, even if I lose, I'll have more fun losing than those other bastards will have winning.
All right. Okay. Well, let's find out a bit about you first. Mark, how did you get to where you are? What sort of person are you, and why did you end up going down the avenue of what you do now?
Well, I'm an unemployable dilettante, Tim. So I kind of got into this initially because I tried to be a musician for a long time. Well, I still am a musician, but I tried properly to be a musician. And then my band got we kind of invented crowdfunding. We got a little deal and then it all fell apart. And the drummer went to jail and all that kind of stuff. And then I kind of sat down and thought, what do I really care about? And I thought, I really care about battling cynicism. I can't bear cynicism because cynicism is just obedience to the status quo, where you bitch about everything and then don't do anything to change it. So I can't bear cynics. I wanted to become the anti-cynic. But I also thought that, you know, people aren't really very well informed by the media and the systems we have about the problems we face, you know, in terms of whether that's climate change or inequality or whatever. There's a very trivial engagement with it. So I wanted to try and engage people seriously. I kind of feel if you engage with people trivially, you'll get trivial engagement back. So I wanted to engage with people seriously, but in a way that was accessible. So I became a stand-up, and I started doing stand-up about climate change and number theory and genetics and gender inequality, seeing if I could turn these big things that I thought were important into accessible things. And I thought it'd be good training for me. And then as a result of that, I got offered a book deal. And I wrote a book called An Optimist Tour of the Future, which is basically nicking Bill Bryson's clothes and going around ideas rather than places and going, look, here's a commentary on all this stuff. And then that turned into, and then I would go and give a talk and people would say, somebody in the back of the audience would go, could you come and talk at my company? And I'd go, I don't know, do you pay? And then they go, yeah, we've got about this much. I go, fuck me, that's a lot more than stand-up. Yeah, I'll come and talk at your company. And so I started doing these corporate talks around like thinking systemically and on innovation and how to think about the future differently. And then people would say, God, could you hang around and give us some consultancy? I said, I don't know, do you pay? And they'd show me their consultancy rates. I go, fuck me. Yeah, no, I'll definitely consult. So I ended up sort of becoming this kind of irritant at a high level for sort of, you know, governments and corporations and NGOs, just basically doing the what the fuckery consultancy, which is the planet's on fire. You've got this engine here to do something about it, or this vehicle, and you're not taking it seriously. So how do we re-architect the way you go about your business, the way you invest, the way you recruit, to do this stuff properly in the service of making the future not completely shit? And that's what I do now.
I suppose the cynicism, which is that the word you use? Sorry, I can't remember now. Was it the word cynicism?
Yeah.
You didn't like people who were constant cynics. This is the problem I have with everybody is, you know, if you look at politics at the moment, people, I always say, look, come on, We've got to change the system. Otherwise, we're going to carry on getting the same people and the same results. And everyone goes, well, you can't. That's the way to do it. That's the only way to do it. And I always say to them, how many prime ministers have there been in the history of Britain? And they go, I don't know. And it's like 51. That's not that many. You know, we can look at other ways of doing things, but people are so stuck. And at the moment, you know, as you say in your book, democracy does not, democracy is the best thing we've got at the moment, but the system we've got at the moment seems to be, you know, you wrote this book a few years ago, and it seems to be that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, and that trend is still going in that direction. Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, we have highest levels of inequality in recorded history now in the UK and in the US and lots of other so-called, you know, Western democracies. So the problem, you know, is that democracy doesn't democratize anything anymore. So it was a leap forward when we invented it sort of 250 years ago. We're still using the same system of democracy that we invented 250 years ago. It'd be like asking you to, you know, put down your iPhone and giving you a Babbage difference engine to do your social media on. It'd be fucking ridiculous. You know, no other business in the world still uses the same machinery it was using 250 years ago and holds that up as a virtue and says, oh, yeah, well, you know, we can't change this. But of course, you know, when you're in that system, it's hard to shift it because people become acculturated to it, you know, and until you can see something different. One of the great things that's happening at the moment, though, is there are the beginnings of quite a lot of participatory systems of government sort of springing up around the world. And one in particular is Taiwan. So Taiwan, after a kind of a bit of a peaceful revolution that happened in there, over there, they now have a system of government that's very participatory and involves the citizens in quite a serious way. And if you want an example of how powerful that can be, when people say, oh, well, you know, can't involve citizens, you know, it's too difficult, it's, you know, and they're not very engaged, you just got to look at their COVID response. So a citizen involved government, where they ask citizens, how are we going to deal with this together? Their death rate per 100,000 is 3.6, and ours is, I think, 217. So if we in the UK had the same response to COVID as Taiwan, which is a similar kind of nation in terms of levels of urbanization and technology and culture and whatever, we'd have had about 3,000 deaths, not 173,000, you know. So there's, you know, to be cynical about that is ridiculous. So there are ways of doing it, but of course you have to get past the current system in order to implement them. But there are some good stuff going. There's some good stuff going on around there, you know. And it's happening quite often more at a municipal level, like at the city level or whatever. You're starting to see participatory budgeting, citizens' assemblies coming on board. And there are some really great examples. But if you engage trivially with somebody, you will get trivial engagement back. So when governments play at this kind of stuff and they say, oh, well, we're putting up £10,000 for your local park, whatever, people go, well, fuck you. I'm not interested in that. But if the city comes to you and say, right, we're putting half the city budget on the table for us to decide between us how we want to spend it, and then people go, okay, you're treating me seriously. I'll engage seriously. So that's what we need to do. And places that have done that have found a massive upswing in how things are going.
Yeah, I'd like to explain that. But just before we get there, what I find frustrating is there's this you know, every time there's an election comes around, everybody's like, we need your vote. We need this. You've got to vote. You've got to vote. And to me, it's like, I mean, I always vote or I always go to the thing. I sometimes destroy my ballot paper. But the thing is, you know, people get angry with that. But I've really genuinely felt in the last general election, I didn't have an option to vote for. There was no one who was standing up for the things that I wanted them to do. And what I find frustrating is if we keep doing the same system constantly over and over and over again, how the hell can it change? Unless people start going, no, we need to rethink this, but you can't rethink it if people go, this is the way it is. It's always been this way and it always will be this way. We do need some sensible people to stand up and go, it hasn't always been this way. It used to be kings and queens ruled us. I mean, they're still in we've still got kings and queens, but we're a queen. We're going to have three kings in a row if we carry on with the monarchy. But you know, it's like it's this weird thing of we need to maybe rethink how we do it all, but no one seems willing to change it at all. They just seem to go along with it. I find that frustrating, don't you?
Yeah, I find it frustrating, but also I work on the side of people who are changing it slowly. I mean, all these things happen in gradations and then there's a big shift. You know, I think it was Vladimir Lenin who said, it's not often I quote Lenin. I usually quote John Lennon, but I'm going to quote Vladimir Lenin. And I think he said something like along the lines of, there are decades where nothing happens, and there are weeks where decades happen, you know.
Oh, right.
And okay. So you suddenly see this, something changes quite readily, as happened in Taiwan. That was something called the Sunflower Revolution that caused that sort of shift in democratic thinking over there, because a bunch of people stormed the parliament, took it over because they were upset about a trade deal that wasn't being scrutinized properly by the government with China. But what they did was they stormed the parliament, they took it over, but it wasn't like some US style capital insurrection. It was, right, we're setting up a whole bunch of discussion groups to go through this trade detail in public. We're going to broadcast it to the nation because the government won't do it transparently. And then the government went, actually, they've got a point. And so they said, fine, okay. And they left, having tidied the whole place up and given it a makeover. And then some of those activists are now ministers. So it can be done, you know, and you have to believe that's possible. But, you know, how it happens is often quite surprising. But saying it will never be done and it can't be done makes you part of the problem. Cynicism is just obedience to the status quo, and we should have absolutely no time for it. You know, if all you can do is complain about it and say it will never change, then fucking just don't get out of bed in the morning. Thank you very much, because we don't need you.
Explain direct democracy then. I mean, there's I think that's what they call it when they you get some examples in your book about what happens in Brazil.
Well, it's participatory democracy, where basically you ask a selection of citizens, and hopefully a cross-section of citizens, what they would do with their own tax dollars. That's participatory budgeting. And actually, it turns out the more marginalized the people you involve in those decisions, the better the decisions are. Because, strangely enough, it's the world's poorest who are living at the margins who make the smartest decisions on where money needs to be spent. And the reason that we don't do it is because of efficiency, essentially. So, you know, it's a lot easier to get three people who look like you and went to the same school as you and taught the same way as you do in City Hall to decide a city budget than it is to engage 10,000, 20,000 citizens on the same problem. So the management overhead of this stuff is really high. There's no getting away from that. It's difficult, it's messy, it's complicated, it's expensive. But the return on investment, and all the research points to this, and even if you go to places like the World Bank, you know, hardly activists, they've done these reports going, people who do this participatory budgeting properly, everything gets better for everybody. Trust in government goes up, poverty goes down, people are happy to pay their taxes, so tax receipts go up even in recession, infant mortality goes down, health care goes, you know, is better, etc. So it's a win-win-win. And actually, you know, the very beginnings of democracy started off sort of in ancient Greece, you know, where there was this thing called a citizens' assembly. Now, obviously, this is ancient Greece, so who qualified as a citizen was slightly limited. In that, you know, women, for instance, weren't considered citizens. But nonetheless, a cross section of society, or at least the male society, would turn up every week on this hill in the middle of Athens and decide on issues of the day, from law, you know, legal issues to taxation issues or whatever. But we got rid of that because it was just not efficient, we thought. But now with technology, we can marry that old idea of engaging lots of people and actually get properly interesting things happening, as has happened in Taiwan and as has been demonstrated by their COVID response. But the problem is, what's broken us is a lack of trust. Like, we don't trust the government, okay? And quite rightly so, because whatever flavor gets in, they tend to do things that seem ridiculous and inefficient and stupid and whatever. What's really also upsetting is the government doesn't trust the people. So, for instance, there are four current, I was going to say current government ministers, but who knows? That's probably changed in the time we've been talking. But, you know, until recently, there were four ministers in our government that wrote a book between them where they basically described their constituents as the worst idlers in the world. So these are government ministers basically saying to the British people, we don't trust them and they're lazy. So you've got a situation where we don't trust the government and the government doesn't trust us. Now, in Taiwan, it's really interesting, because if you go and talk to Audrey Tang, who's basically their head of participatory government, you say, you know, this, you say to her, well, the citizens must really trust the government to allow them to, you know, have these conversations. And she says, no, it's not about that. It's not about the citizens trusting the government. It's about the government trusting the citizens. We trust them to make the right decisions. And if you engage with them in a proper way, they generally come up with a pretty good response, as our COVID response showed.
I always think with the politicians, what sort of people are you getting? Why are they doing it? Because, you know, if they're the smartest guys in town, there's a lot more money to be made than being a politician, right? So you've got to understand the reason why they're doing it. And you know, we can't be naive and ignorant enough to think that people aren't motivated by money. So they're clearly motivated by status and power. What sort of people are you getting into the jobs if that is the motivation to do it? And I always think it's, you know, often it was businessmen who'd made a lot of money who then decided to go into it, or people who'd run unions on the left, you know, so there was the difference. But it's changed now. You sort of got a political class coming through, haven't you? And I've got to, you know, I always think, and I'm talking about Britain here, why are they doing it? Are they doing it just in the good of their heart? No, they're possibly doing it for status and power, and maybe that's not the right metric we need to get someone to be running things. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You have got a culture now of a political class. And it's funny because, you know, you say it's supposed to be the best and the brightest. I mean, you know, if you just look at, I mean, I'm not making a political point, but I mean, let's talk about the current government. So I'm not making an anti-Tory point. I'm just taking the existing government, which is kind of like, if you look at the level of leadership and competence there, and I've had engagements with various government departments, including the Cabinet Office during COVID, it's really very, very poor. And it's not necessarily because they're stupid. It's because they're limited in the way they think, because they all went to roughly the same four or five schools. They all speak roughly the same kind of way, and they all roughly have the same kind of opinions. So they planned lockdown for a bunch of people like themselves, not because they were necessarily malicious, but because they were uninformed. I mean, I don't know who it was said, they never attribute to cruelty what you can attribute to incompetence or something like that. You know, they're just not very broad, and if you're going to have a government, it needs to be a government of the people, for the people, by the people. And what we have at the moment is a government of very few people for the benefit of those same people, and fuck the rest of us. And I think that's just the way the system's built, you know, but it can be challenged, and you know, we'll get there eventually. I mean, we're moving through a Carol.
I do think these people, I do think politicians and politics are brainwashers, including the media, by the way, to believe that these people know something we don't. And yet the same people...
I think that's been revealed to be completely hocus now.
But I still think people do. I mean, look, I'm on plenty of WhatsApp groups with my mates who stand up for a lot of these politicians and stuff, and they go, it's the system, they know what they're doing, there's a secret behind it, these guys know. And I'm thinking, do you really think that? And what I always find so strange in the cabinet is how you can move from one job, health, to defense, to something. It's like, surely there must be an expert in this. You know, you can't just take someone out of, you know, the your back benches and say, oh, by the way, you're an expert on three different things as long as you show loyalty to me. It just seems insanity to me that we've got this in place. It's like, if you're talking about health, go and find an expert on the system and everything. But that's not how it works, is it? It's jobs for the boys.
Yeah, I mean, it's a ridiculous system, and I often use this thought experiment when I'm working with clients of mine, you know, to help them think outside of their current set of prejudices. Like, say, if you were an alien and you come into orbit around the planet and you look down and try to describe, say, the British governmental system, and you had no knowledge of it, Brucey, how would you describe it? And you'd have to describe it as pathologically insane. In the same way that if you describe the education system, you know, he looks at the education, Ken Robertson said this rather brilliantly. He said, if you looked at it from outer space, you'd have to conclude that the education system was designed to create professors.
Yeah.
But not, and I always say that if you looked at the human race as a whole, you know, looking at it from outer space, an alien would conclude, well, what these people do is turn environmental degradation into short-term profit for a very small number of the born lucky. Hmm. You know, so you've got to get outside of where you are. But of course, if you're born into a system, you see it that way and you reinforce it. Upton Sinclair said, very difficult to get somebody to understand something when their salary depends upon them not understanding it. And indeed, if you try and tell people or even show them the evidence that what they're doing is kind of bizarre, you know, they'll often double down emotionally and kind of go, no, hold on to it even stronger. So people have a real strong emotional attachment to stuff they've believed previously because that's how they define themselves. So your mates on your WhatsApp group, they may be thinking in the back of their head, you know, actually, I don't really think the system's working, but I've been a Labour supporter or a Tory all my life, and I've kind of invested a part of my identity in that. And to go back on that now is going to be a kind of an emotional threat. So you have to understand the emotional drivers of tribalism as well, and kind of break through that. And a lot of what I do in my work is break through that by saying, look, stop left, stop right. What are we going to build? You both agree this is a problem. What's the thing we're going to build together?
Yeah, I read Tony Blair's book, and it was a long time ago now, though. It's not been in power for a while. And it did say this thing that I've never forgotten, where he said, you have all the best intentions as a politician, and then you get into power, and, you know, he's got the biggest majority ever getting voted in, and he's there, and he's the whole country behind him. And he says, as soon as you're in power, you realize it doesn't matter whether it's a good idea or a bad idea you come up with. The opposition will say it's rubbish, right? Because And that's the nature of politics, and we kind of need the opposing view. And he says, but then you find your own party, like Gordon Brown, I think he was implying, they're also attacking you as well. So politics is not an industry to help the people. It's a power game. And this is where the fundamental problem is. Now, what the politicians and the media or the people who are discussing politics always say is, we need this because you need to hold politicians accountable. But at the same time, we need a little bit of we do also need adults in the room to actually discuss things as well. And I mention adults in the room because every time I've mentioned PMQs to a politician or someone who's involved in politics, they say it's the greatest thing in the world because you hold the Prime Minister accountable. And I always say it's the most horrific thing because the general public go, none of us would sit in a meeting, right, where that was happening and not go, well, guys, we need to calm this down. You know, this is not going anywhere. This is horrific. Let's take it to court if we're this angry with each other. You know, and so I just feel we need some adults in it. The PMQs is ridiculous, isn't it? And the way they behave.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. And I mean, I've often had this beef with the media. So if you take, for instance, like Newsnight, you know, and there'll be some discussion, you know, there'll be some debate about, I don't know, education or climate change or whatever, blah, blah. And they'll get somebody in from the left and they'll get somebody in from the right and they'll go, let's talk about this. And they'll argue about it. And they go, thank you very much and good night. And to me, it's like, well, that's just ridiculous because you both agree it's a problem. Surely the interviewer should be going like, well, so you both agree it's a problem. You both agree it's important. You both have differing views on this, which is useful because we need lots of, you know, diverse views on these things. What are you going to do together? How are you going to work together to solve this problem? And the system is set up to be tribal and competitive rather than cooperative. And the reason that journalists do that is because it's cheap. To actually understand the issues and ask intelligent questions and say, well, how might we solve it together? You actually have to understand the subject you're talking about. But to actually just get people to shout at each other, all you have to do is ask some provocative questions. And that makes journalism cheap. Actually, solutions journalism, which is a whole area of journalism, is all about how do we fix these things together. And there's some great publications doing that. That's expensive journalism because the journalists actually have to know what they're talking about. And that is not something that journalists are very good at. Even though they like to hold themselves up as these rather brilliant experts and arbiters of public taste, they're usually very, very shallow in their understanding of things. And there are many multiple exceptions, I'll have to say. But most journalists, by nature of the way they're employed and the way they have to churn through the news, have almost no understanding of the stuff they're being asked to report at. So what's easiest? Get somebody from the left, get somebody from the right, get into argue with each other. There's your article. There's your 5 minutes of TV. Thank you very much. Good night. Nothing about solving the problem. Journalism says nothing about solving things at the moment. And that's another systemic failure, which I kind of worry about.
Yeah, and I do agree with you there. It's you know, it seems that they need to ring fence things like energy, national health and stuff and say that we need cross-party here. We need to work together to help this. I think we all know, we've all got examples of people who work in the NHS who are so sick of every time a new government comes in, the system changes and things change. It's like, come on, we need to stabilize this. And it can't be a political potato, hot potato, can it? The NHS, it's got to be ring fenced and said, we need to look after this because everybody loves the NHS and both sides, I imagine, want to look after it. So let's try and work out a way that we can, you know, cross party, look after that. Do you not think?
Yeah, I agree. And there are some precedents for doing that. So, for instance, you know, we have the Office of Budget Responsibility now, which was, you know, the beginnings of actually we're going to agree that the statistics about the economy are done by an independent body funded by the government that is neither left nor right. It used to be that, you know, the government would get in power and they say, well, here are our figures on the economy. And the opposition would go, well, no, here are our figures on the economy. And now we have the Office of Budget Responsibility that goes, well, this is the truth. Or at least as we see it. I mean, you can question some of their methodologies. But, you know, so there are precedents for doing that. And there's some stuff happening in the environment where that's going to happen as well. But, you know, this stuff is slow and it takes a long time. And, you know, I mean, government is like making sausages, isn't it? You know, you just don't want to see what happens in the sausage machine. It's pretty ugly. Yeah.
Who are you advising then these days? What sort of companies and people are you talking to?
Well, until recently, I was advising the Ministry of Defence on national security and climate change, and also advising on their net zero strategy. So there was that. I did a bit of work for the Cabinet Office on a few things. I've been working with Medicines Sans Frontières, the NGO, a couple of corporations, advising some investment funds that are doing stuff that hopefully will have an impact on climate, that kind of stuff. Generally, sort of, you know, making a nuisance of myself when I'm not playing in a prog rock band.
How do you find out the facts and the figures and what's happening? How are you researching it so that you've got the information they require?
Well, to be honest, I'm not often required to bring the information, although obviously I have a lot of access to that. What I'm usually required to do is bring a different perspective, which is a different emotional way of looking at things and kind of asking questions they don't know they should have asked themselves. So I'm usually the person going, there, you're asking yourself the wrong questions. Here are some questions you should be asking yourself. And that's what I'm usually asked to do. So I'm usually trying to provoke them into thinking differently rather than relying on the existing truth as they see it. It's like, let's imagine better. Let's stretch the culture of the possible, and let's go and see what we might go and do together. And then let's go and do that.
Yeah, I think that's, but there must be stuff you come across in your travels. You must spend a lot of time being informed on what's going on in the world. Like, there's one bit in your book where there's a guy who's Dr. John Ion Denis. I don't know how to pronounce his name. Ion Denis.
Yeah.
Ionides. Yeah. Who does research.
Ion Adidas, I think. Yeah.
Ion Adidas, that's it, right? He does research on research. And I remember buying a book once called How to Read a Book. I mean, and it was funny because it was like, you know, we're all reading books and this book taught you how to read books. And I thought that was funny, and I didn't read much of it, if I'm honest with you. But research on research, I thought thought that was really clever, because it's like, are we doing the right research? And he discovered we weren't when it came to health. Things like that are amazing, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, so the question is, what is truth? And truth is very hard to pin down because everybody's got an opinion on it. So then there are these proposed methods for finding the truth, scientific method, various types of research methodology. The problem with all of them is they're done by people, and people are inherently biased. And what John pointed out was that, like, you know, even the scientific method, there are all these little bits of leeways where you know, often subconsciously you're kind of nudging the research in the direction you want because that's what you feel is the right thing. And therefore, but then he did say, the great bit about research says, and the way that you get past that is by applying these principles, and the best quality research you will find will have these characteristics. And if you see research that has these characteristics, then you can pretty much rely on it as being true. So it's just about, you know, going like, what is the best quality? But of course, the best quality research is often expensive, and that's why we don't do it.
And we've all got bias, haven't we? And this is, I suppose that's part of your job, is to try and get rid of the bias. I know I have bias, and I've noticed myself do it a lot recently. And noticing it, I think, is half the battle, isn't it? I'm like, oh, I just immediately thought that. You know, there's the classic riddles where you always say doctor to someone. You mention the word doctor, and they always think it's a man, so they can't get the riddle. And then it goes, the doctor's a woman. So that's the classic bias riddle that people do. But we've all got it, haven't we?
Yeah. I mean, I like to say, if you want to find the nearest prejudiced person, you just go and look in the mirror. Right. And I say that with, you know, prejudice of the small p, because every single one of us is a victim of a number of things. First of all, the year you were born and what was happening in the world, the country you were born into and what kind of government, whether it was in peace or wartime or whether it was an autocratic government or a democratic government, or whatever, the very language you speak changes the way you think about stuff. So, you know, if you have friends who are bilingual or you're bilingual, you'll know you think differently in a different language. The technology that was around when you were growing up, the bands or music or arts and culture that influenced you in those critical teenage years, all of this colors your thinking. So you tend to see the world through that lens. And of course, then to change the world, to innovate, to do the innovation we need, almost by definition, all the innovation you need is outside of your own set of prejudices, because inside your own set of prejudices is not innovative, it's comfortable. So you need to take people outside of their sort of bubbles to show them where the real innovation is and where all the fun is, by the way. That's where all the interesting stuff is. And that's what I do a lot with my work. It's kind of like, let's go and examine what your prejudices are. Let's find out what they are. Let's bring them out into the light. Let's destroy them. And let's go and work on something new and exciting.
I always think the battle between the generations is the biggest thing we've always got, which everyone sort of really ignores. They always talk about difference in class and difference in race and stuff and cultures, but the generations are so different. And I sit down sometimes with my daughters, who are very politically engaged, and my parents, who are politically engaged, and my mum especially. And my daughters and my mum, I've got such different views on feminism. It's incredible, you know, with all the difference in generations. But the one thing I was saying to my mum the other day, they're really angry when people have a go at someone like Winston Churchill. My parents were born in the war. And what people don't realize is if you start pulling down Winston Churchill statues, or you start saying Winston Churchill's a bad man, you're devaluing their lives, because they bought into that. Because they were young and they got through a war and he was treated as their hero. If you're devaluing their 80 years of life, you know, by saying that. And so you've got to be very careful to understand what people's values are and how they've based their whole life experience on before you start, you know, breaking it all down. I think this is what's happening all over the world at the moment. The younger generation own the internet, and the older generation feel really put out by it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem we have is back to the beginning of our conversation, which is a lack of, you know, an understanding of systems and complexity, and the fact that everything is a grey area. And that's the world I live in. It's like, you know, everything is connected to everything else, and there is no, you know, there's no perfect leader. You know, Winston Churchill was as flawed an individual as anybody else. He had many great characteristics. But our history doesn't teach us that, because it's comfortable to say, oh, well, we were great and we won, all that kind of stuff. So it's actually much better to have a nuanced understanding of yourself and your nation and your culture in all of its kind of goodness and badness. And we don't teach that. We don't encourage people to think that. But a really good example of difference, I think, of this that I always use, I find quite amusing, is a difference between Christians and heavy metal fans in their response to The Life of Brian and Spinal Tap, right? So both of those films are essentially parodies of the thing that they love, all right?
Yeah.
Christians, absolutely outraged by The Life of Brian, because they were so attached to, say, to this emotion, you can't possibly question this is so sacred to me or whatever. Okay. Heavy metal fans absolutely adore Spinal Tap, because they can see that, yes, I love heavy metal music, but I can also see that it is also ridiculous and its own parody. And actually, by doing that, you know, Spinal Tap celebrates heavy metal as much as it ridicules it. In a way, you know, so to have that full understanding of yourself, to kind of go, yes, I am complex, difficult. Now, my nation is complex and difficult. And that's where comedy comes in at its best. And it's also like, you know, you on Sunday brunch when you're doing stuff, there's always that little playfulness, like, yeah, we're all a bit weird and all a bit difficult. And that's just a bit funny, isn't it? And, you know, that is where we all really engage. And kind of, if you can often use humor to go, look, we're being ridiculous and we know it. And then we laugh at that and see that truth. We get released from that cognitive bubble. We can understand the complexity. And the problem with the culture wars and these tribes is they're all terribly, terribly serious. And nobody wants to have a laugh and go, hang on, this is bloody ridiculous. Can we stop for a moment and have a joke? So I'm always trying to use humor to burst the bubble.
I suppose the difference, though, between heavy metal and religion is religious people have invested a lot. I'm not religious, by the way. I don't have one. So I find the whole thing, I never had one. I didn't grow up that way either. I'm not even christened, but I suppose they've invested a lot of time. They've put all their money, all their chips down on Jesus, you know, Christianity. Yeah. And it's so they've got a lot riding on it. So I suppose when you've spent the whole of your life, whereas in a heavy metal, you can start going, do you know what? I've listened to some jazz funk the other day and I think I might give that a try. You know, I think I'm going to move towards that, and no one's going to, you know, you haven't wasted the whole of your life in a leather jacket and long hair headbanging or something. So let's look at some positives, yeah. Mark. I always think that one of the positives bit before we get back to negatives, because you are a positive guy, is health. That, I mean, that just, that industry is exploding, isn't it? And you know, things like crowdfunding health. I'm not sure I've got the right word there with crowdfunding, but I think I have. And the internet being able to connect more people, more stats. The computers are getting more analytical, so able to look at more samples. It's moving really rapidly, isn't it? The medical industry, the health industry.
Yeah, and actually this is a really good example of how we're getting things right and wrong simultaneously, that nuanced thing. So, you know, the current healthcare system is not a healthcare system, right? It's a sick care system. Like, right. Nobody gets paid until you're ill. So an example in the UK, you know, we spend £14 billion a year, the NHS, on diabetes care. And 90% of that is lifestyle. So the question is, you know, what are we doing? You know, and could we spend that £14 billion a bit earlier on, I don't know, on sports clubs and, you know, and taxing sugar or whatever, blah, blah, blah. So that's a kind of a sick care system, you know, spending £14 billion on people that really, if we'd have managed our lives better, shouldn't have been ill in the first place. Okay. But then there's all these other things going on, like the ability of people with rare diseases to find other people with the same rare disease as the internet. So actually now we have a whole bunch of people that can act together and do research, because it used to be that only four people, you know, in my country have this disease. Now we have 100 of us that have this, and we can actually crowdfund research and whatever. And one of the things I talk about in the book is this organization called Patients Like Me, which is exactly that. Basically, people go in and say, I've got, I don't know, Crohn's disease or some, you know, something else. And then suddenly you could find this community of people who've all got the same sort of thing. And then you can actually find somebody who's like, oh, well, somebody who's the same age as me, at the same stage of the disease as me, same weight, same height, how are they experiencing it? And then they started also taking a lot of data and recording data and actually using that to research and find out, actually, for you, the best intervention is this, and for you, the best, rather than giving the same treatment to everybody. So it became a much more nuanced and impersonalized view of healthcare. And it's, you know, they've been using it now to help develop better quality drugs and all sorts. So this kind of crowdsourced healthcare is a really, really great idea. But it challenges, of course, a lot of existing prejudices. So one of the things it challenges is the idea of the doctor or the physician knowing everything. And of course, doctors and physicians like to be in positions of power, because it's kind of comfortable. People come to me and make me well and whatever, that kind of stuff. So when you say, actually, us as a group of patients probably know more about this disease than you do, because we're living with it every day and we understand the way that you don't, that can be challenging. When it works really well is when you've got the expert physician who's very happy to work with a bunch of informed patients, and then you get this double whammy of, oh yeah, me as a clinician understands this, but you as the patients understand that. And if we bring that knowledge together, wow, now we're really kicking on gas and do some fantastic innovation. So, you know, there's that sort of stuff going on. So, yeah, you know, as with all these things, good and bad.
Yeah, I'm always wondering what the end game is, though, for humans. If we sat down with some, you know, some of these guys who work in the health industry, said, what is it that we want? We want every single person born in the world to live to 120. Is that the end game, you know, without any disease and a really healthy life and then drop dead on their 120th birthday or something? What is it? What are we trying to achieve here? Because we're getting to a stage where surely it's going to be better to look at the embryo and try and fix all the diseases before they're born. We're getting to that stage, aren't we, than actually being born. Or actually, no, look at the egg and the sperm and go, all right, let's get the healthiest egg, the healthiest sperm. Let's cut out all the crap so you know we're going to get the best people and they're going to live to 120.
Yeah. So you're never going to get rid of disease, because disease is really a function of multicellularity, in that cells divide. And when they divide, there's always going to be some errors, you know, at some level or whatever. And as we get older and the division gets a little bit worse, you're always going to get that. So what we really want is to have as long a health span as possible, to live as long in a healthy way, because that's good, because that's productive and it's nice and it's much better than being old and whatever. I think the problem we have is our philosophical, and there are several philosophical problems that humans have to deal with. And the first one is that we all accept death as an inevitability, and yet every single one of us wants to carry on living. And that's one of the things that human beings really don't want to talk about. The other big things are, and we're all trying to find meaning in our lives, and yet the universe seems essentially meaningless. We all want to have agency in our lives and feel we're in control of it, but obviously there's a whole bunch of things we aren't in control of. So we all have to deal with these constant battles inside our psyche. And one of them is about death. And I think our whole conversation about healthcare is underpinned by what we think about death and trying not to think about it. I think it would be much better if we had cultures where we talked about death from the get-go and we discussed it and brought it into culture as a much more positive thing. You lived a good life, you were well loved, and you lived well, and you were healthy for, you know, pretty much all of it until the end, and we accept your death as a joyous gift back to the universe or something like that. You know, at the moment it's like, let's not talk about it. Quick, give him some drugs before he so we can keep him alive for a few more months in this horrible, disgusting state. There's a joke. I've got some friends who are cancer doctors, and that one of the jokes is they often tell is, why do why do they put nails in the top of coffins? And it says to stop the cancer doctors getting in and trying one last thing.
That's very interesting. I was going to say that to you. We're maybe not looking at the right way. Maybe we should spend more time on looking at death and looking forward to death rather than not looking forward to it. And I know in some cultures they do. I did an interview with a palliative nurse, and one of the things we had here was in the middle of the last century, we suddenly started being able to cure people of illnesses which would kill people, like heart disease and cancer and stuff. And so everybody starts thinking they should constantly be healed. And also, I know for a fact that another person told me once that it was because we lost so many people in the war. Everybody stopped talking about death a lot because so many people were being lost. But the other thing is, I know for a fact that your body is in survival mode constantly. So it's a very hard thing for humans just to go, I accept it. Eventually, when you're dying, you do accept it. But there's a bit of you, your body wants to fight always because it's in survival mode. That's what your body does. It's always looking for food. It's always looking for, you know, to breathe. It's constantly trying to survive. And so the conscious bit, the free will bit of you, has to eventually override and say, I'm ready to die, because that's what your body's trying to do constantly, is survive. So I've been told that by a couple of people now, that that's why we one of the reasons we struggle with death so much. But
this ties back to our question earlier about systems, because systems do the same thing. Governmental systems, they carry on, they want to breathe, they want to survive, they want to carry on going. And at some point, there comes a point where they have to accept they're going to die. And that's the cathartic shifting moment, you know. And that happened with Magna Carta. And, you know, suddenly the old sort of a subject system where we're all subjects of the king started to realize it had to die. And we moved slowly to a sort of a democratic or consumer-based system where we had a choice of people who could represent us. And now we have to move from that into real citizenship, where we all engage in work together. And this is, I'm talking about, I'm referencing the work of John Alexander now, who's written a fantastic book called Citizen, which is all about that shift from seeing ourselves as consumers to seeing ourselves as citizens. And that requires a different set of systems. And that means the old systems have to get to that point where they go, you know what, I'm going to override my desire to keep on breathing, because that's how I pay myself and my staff, and realize this thing has to die and make way for the new. And that's what we're going to live through in the next 30 years. The next 30 years are going to be this wholesale change in economics, politics, are in relationship with the environment and each other. They're necessarily going to have to be.
Interesting you should say. It's, I read this thing once that if you put someone in charge of, I don't know, I'm making it up here, bullying. If you start a department looking for bullying, they'll find bullying because that's their job. So you've got to be careful when you assign people to a job like that. It should be part of somebody else's job, because if you actually set up a department to do it, then clearly they're going to find it because that's their job. No one turns around and says, I can't find, can you close this down now? I can't find anything. They'll start looking until, and we've got confirmation bias too. So they'll go, I think, let's redefine bullying here, because, you know, because that's what they'll do. That's what they'll think about, and that's what happens, apparently.
There's a great quote by a writer called Eli Goldratt. He died now, but he was a kind of a business guru in the 80s, and was a particle physicist, I think, by training. And he said this great thing. He said, tell me how you're going to measure me, but if you measure me strangely, don't be surprised if I act perversely. And so we've got to think about what the right measures are. So one of the things, for instance, I do with my clients when it comes to talking about the environment is I now, if I'm at a board level, I'm saying your board remuneration package is going to be tied financially as much to your environmental performance as your commercial performance, so that people will now have a bigger pay packet if they aggressively reduce their carbon emissions. So that's a really good way of measuring people in a way that encourages the right action. If you just say to people, you get richer the more you rape the planet, then guess what? They're just going to go and rape the planet, because if you measure me strangely, I'll act perversely.
Definitely. Well, let's talk about the environment then. I've got a friend who's set up a company doing very well, which is goes around, audits people's companies, and then tells them their carbon footprints, and then they're doing it. They're paying him to do it. So things seem to be, like, let's be optimistic, in the right direction. And he then advises them how to get their carbon footprint down, and he gets paid to do this. So, you know, it's costing them money to do it. So clearly there's a conscience happening, environmental conscience happening out there in corporations. Clearly it's not probably going fast enough, is it?
No, but it is going. And there are a number of reasons for that. The first is that, yes, I think people have woken up to it. And certainly you've got a generation of leaders coming into positions of power now, sort of more like your age, who have kind of grown up with some appreciation of the environment. And so there's that. Also, we're now living, there's none of us can avoid the fact that the biosphere is in trouble. You know, COVID was a symptom of our, you know, encroachment on the biosphere. The heat wave that we've just lived through as we're recording this, you know. And so people are kind of getting, going, okay, something's got to change. But also what we're realizing is that we're going to be legislated into taking this stuff seriously anyway. Businesses are reading the writing on the wall and going like, okay, if I look at the policy moves that are happening in government, and you know, some of these I've hopefully been a little bit involved with, are saying, right, I now have to have a net zero plan. Like the government said at COP26, if you're over a certain size, you are legally required to publish a plan to get yourself to net zero. That plan doesn't have to be any good, by the way, and most of them aren't. In fact, most of them are terrible, but you have to at least pay lip service to it. Now, pretty soon, it's going to be that net zero plan has to be good. And by the way, you are now legally required to remove the emissions that you are putting into the atmosphere. And then, by the way, if you do that, the better you are at it, the lower your corporation tax will be. So there's a real business incentive to get on top of it as well because of the legislation. But also, just fundamentally, if we destroy our own spaceship, there will be no business left anyway. Also, Businesses that take sustainability, regeneration, gender equality, all that stuff seriously, all the research says they outperform their competitors in the long run in terms of both stock market performance and accounting performance. They make more money and they're more valuable because they employ people who are happier to work there, that those people are more creative, they take less time off work, because 80% of people hate their jobs. Companies that take the environment and stuff seriously, generally people who work there are happier to work there and feel more engaged. And that translates into better products, better services, better customer service, blah, 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 blah. You know, so in the long run, it makes sense to get on top of this stuff because everybody's happier, the world functions better. And we're slowly realizing that. But I think it was, going back to Winston Churchill, said this great thing. He said, and he was saying it about Americans. He said, Americans are a wonderful people. They will always do the right thing when they've exhausted all of the possibilities. And I think it's kind of like the human race is a bit like that. It's kind of like, we'll finally get around to it and go, oh, yeah, all right, we should probably do the right thing. And I think we're kind of at that moment now.
So I've got a real conscience on this recently. And I've got electric car, e-car, because I've been told to do that. I've got an e-bike and a pedal bike, push bike. And I've said this a few times. Solar's getting fitted. It was cancelled. I've decided to do it because I've got the money to do it. So I thought I should make the effort. I'm trying not to fly around much. I'm doing holiday in Britain this year. All these sort of things. I'm sort of getting a bit conscious. But then I read this week that the 100... there's 100 companies which provide 71% of the carbon emissions. Top of the pile was, I think, Chinese coal, obviously owned by the government Communist Party, 4.1 or 4.6 or something like that. And I'm like, hold on. So the real problem here is not, it's like we say about the NHS earlier, we need cross-party. What we really need now in the planet is not me cleaning out a Marmite jar. We need cross-country nations now. China must be aware. They're smog and they must be seeing climate change. You know? By the way, all of them are oil and coal companies on this top 100 list. Surely it's about time we sort of go, all right, these guys are going to lose their money and their power, but we need to have empathy with that and work out how we can stop this happening, generate enough power for us all, and do it across the world to work out how we can do this. Because it's just, we're never going to do it by me cleaning out a Marmite jar, are we? We need to speak to all these people. Again, it's got to be an adult conversation with the globe and saying, because China aren't going to give it up because they're doing well now. They're at the top of the pile. So, you know, why the hell are they going to go and cut this and ruin their... By the way, it's 4 point something. And then when you drop down, it's something 2 point something, then 1 point something. So they clearly are the biggest problem in the globe at the moment. We need to engage with them. And I think we just ignore China, don't we? We won't have anything to do with them at the moment. So
Well, I mean, that's the failure of again, the press and the partisan of the press, because yes, there's a lot that's problematic about China, and there's a lot that they are doing, which is absolutely fantastic, which doesn't get talked about because it's far easier to have them either as evil or as good. And like all of us, you know, they are a nuanced nation. So, for instance, I represent, I'm an ambassador for an organization called Client Earth, with the biggest environmental law charity, and we enforce environmental and business law. And in fact, yesterday, as we record this, we won a case against the UK government by proving that its net zero strategy wasn't legal, basically. And now they've got to go and revisit it. So one of the things we did at Client Earth was they called us in and said, look, you know, we need some decent environmental law here, and we need citizens to be able to take environmental polluters to court in China. So we wrote them a whole bunch of environmental law, which they basically cut and paste. And then we went and trained the Supreme Court, and we went and trained thousands of prosecutors. And recently we had a conversation with them, and they said, how's it going? And they said, oh, it's been a bit disappointing. We haven't had that many cases brought so far. And we said, how many? And they said, oh, it's only about 170,000. You know, so the Chinese government fully understands the need for a low carbon world. And they've got a plan to get there. It's not perfect, like nobody's is. And they are working towards that. One of the things that we were able to help them stop doing, for instance, in the work at Client Earth, was they were going to be building coal-fired power stations across the world, and in Africa in particular, and this thing called the Belt and Road Initiative to power it. That's all being canned now. They're not doing that. So there is a lot of movement going on over there. And if you're just cynical about it and say they're not engaging, well, that's not true. You know, but there is engagement going on, but it's not perfect. There are things that they aren't getting right. But we are working with them, and they do understand. Like, they understand if they want to maintain a top dog position, they can't do that in a world on fire, you know, because climate change knows no borders. My work with the military, you know, was about getting together an international declaration on cooperation at a military level on climate change, because climate change is the biggest national security threat to every citizen in the world. I think I've got to check this at the moment, but even the Ukraine's national security analysis says that the biggest threat to Ukrainians is not Vladimir Putin, but climate change. And so I instigated this agreement signed by the G7 in Europe so far, which says that we're going to collaborate at a state level on peace initiatives and climate change, and as soldiers tell our governments that this is our biggest national security threat. So that sort of stuff is going on, but it doesn't get talked about. I mean, that declaration, which I was pretty proud of and got, you know, quite some big signatures, you didn't get a peep of it in the press. And the environmental law stuff that Client Earth did in China, you'll never have heard of it. So again, you know, it's very easy to be cynical, and if you don't get involved, then it's like, well, you know, you just believe what you're told. Of course you do. Whereas if you start making change, and so back to your point about whether, if you engage yourself at whatever level, even if it's quite small, you become less cynical, and then you become more attuned to hearing this other stuff, and then you start to find other people who are less cynical, and then before you know it, things are getting better in your own perspective of the world, your own feeling of agency, even if what you're doing is quite small. I mean, Gandhi said it best. He said, what you do will be insignificant, but it's really important that you do it.
Yeah, I agree with that totally. I spend all my time looking at the future and stuff on the internet about the future and stuff, because I've always found it fascinating, and I've done a load of stuff on it, done some documentaries on it, actually mini documentaries. But I do love that. I just feel that being the cynical person that you don't like, is that the idea of getting those top 100 companies to stop, I mean, the profit they're making is phenomenal, and it's funding their cars and their yachts and their lives. The idea that they're not going to do that is... Yeah, or I'm just not sure I'm buying it, you know, unless it becomes from a world, you know, the world are going, we need to stop this. I think that's the angle of it. Is that not true? Or do you think they're going to start their businesses?
Well, you know, we've been through this before, you know, and we're going to go through it again. The point is, if you believe it's not possible, it certainly isn't. Now you can say, well, is it likely? Well, maybe not at the moment, but there are lots of things that weren't likely before. If I'd have said to you even 5 years ago that basically the EU and the UK have basically said no more internal combustion engines by 2035, you'd have gone, that's ridiculous, that'll never happen. If I'd gone back 30 years and said there's going to be a smoking ban in all public places, you said that will never happen. You know, If I'd have said there'll be gay marriage 50 years ago, you said that will never happen. So Bill Gates said this great thing. He says, we always overestimate what we can achieve in 2 years and completely underestimate what we can achieve in 10. So this stuff is slow, and changing the future is a contact sport. And that's where, you know, I get involved all the time. And, you know, whether it's working with Client Earth or whether it's, you know, I've worked with oil and gas companies. I've worked with government. I've worked with, you know, I'm working with bands at the moment on sustainable touring and all that kind of stuff. You know, you just have to do what you can, where you are with what you've got. And you, Tim, particularly, you've got a massive stage, and you're very well liked and loved. And you also help us make delicious food and all that kind of stuff. What you do, Tim, will be completely insignificant because you're just Tim Lovejoy. But it's really important that you do it. And it's the same for all of us. We just have to do what we can, where we are. And you will become more concerned about the world, which is upsetting. But you'll feel that your agency has gone up to do something about it, which is really empowering.
Well, interestingly, my friends who work in the oil industry in Norway have said they're pivoting. All of them are pivoting towards renewable energy. So they've all the companies, that's what they're trying to invest in. And so that's established and that's happening there. And I suppose, you know, if you went back 5 years and said that I'd be driving an electric car, I would be going, I can't imagine it. Only because, I say this on the podcast all the time, I think the idea that my car's electric is so exciting. I'm like in Tron or something. It's so wonderful. And I think that the idea that my life is going to be powered by the sun is just so bloody exciting. Not like, oh, it's so expensive. I'm just like, wow, my life is going to be powered by the big yellow thing in the sky. I think that's more exciting than being powered by coal or something. Look, we're running out of time, but just very quickly, I want to talk about education. I did a podcast, many documentaries. I just talked about them. And one of them was education, which was a big thing on there. And the guy there, I can't remember his name now, it escapes me, but he'd started doing this sort of schooling in India where they just stick, rather than the traditional learning subjects, just, you know, they're getting through exams, they were teaching kids by giving them problems and ideas, and they were sticking it in a classroom, and they were saying, you know, let's get them working. And, you know, reading your book, it seems that there's an example of that in your book. And I think, how are we still stuck? You know, I thought the pandemic was a great opportunity for us to look at how we deal with death. And also, I thought it was a great opportunity to maybe change the education system as well, which I think is really antiquated. And it just seems so ridiculous that we put that much pressure on children. And the amount of children who hate school rather than enjoy school just frustrates the hell out of me. What are they doing in schools to make it so miserable for them? We wouldn't put up with it in the workforce with adults, so why are we letting it happen with children? So if you explain the example and in the book, and I mean, again, the reason it's staying there is it's a good way of people judging it, isn't it? We can judge it if they're taking exams, and it's just such an antiquated, stupid way of educating our children.
Yeah, well, on a couple of points there. When you say we wouldn't do it, it's in workplaces. Actually, we do. 80% of people don't like their jobs. So let's get that very clear. You know, most people don't like their work.
You can go to HR and say, the stress levels here on me are ridiculous, and then they can investigate it because there are HR, and you can have whistleblowers now. There's no such thing at school. Do your work or you're going to fail is basically the deal we've got going.
Yeah. Oh, hang on. Talking of education, my three-year-old is saying, Daddy, hang on. Just tell him to. Hey, little one. Come here. Come here.
Nanny, get out the nice and forks.
Helping Nanny get out the nice and forks. Come and say hello to Tim. This is Tim. And this is my littlest, Harris.
Hiya.
Tim's a big celebrity. Tim's a big celebrity.
Oh, yeah, huge.
Give him a wave.
How you doing, Harris?
Could you go downstairs? Can you go to help Nanny?
Where's Emmett?
I don't know where Emmett is. I think he's probably in his bedroom playing Lego. Okay. Thanks so much control you have. So where were we?
Education and stress of children.
And let me shut the door because I can still hear them chittering in the background. So yeah, you're absolutely right. But back to that point we made earlier that, you know, if you tell me how you're going to measure me, don't be surprised if I act perversely. And the way we measure what we do in education is we value the things we can measure, okay, which is, you know, can this person do a sum? Can this person spell correctly? You know, things that are easy to measure are what you will end up doing. And the problem with a rounded education or a rounded human being is, you know, that all the stuff that's really important is almost impossible to measure. Now, how do you measure if somebody is really good at finding the right question? How do you measure empathy? How do you measure the ability to collaborate with people who aren't like you? Yeah, all the stuff that makes, you know, good leadership, that's very subjective and very culturally dependent as well. So therefore, we tend not to measure those things because it's just too hard. Now, there is quite a lot of work going on, indeed, by people like PISA, who are the sort of the big standards agency, trying to think about how can we change those measurements to incorporate more of that stuff. But yes, essentially, the problem is we want to be able to manage something, and you can't, the famous maxim, you can't manage what you can't measure. But in education, the things that are important are almost unmeasurable. So we measure, I wouldn't say they're unimportant, it's still important that your kids can spell and add up and all this kind of stuff. But really, creativity and serendipity creation and all that sort of stuff, very hard to measure. And so that's where we are, However, there are ways around that. So, you know, what you should really do, I think, is co-design a school with children. Children are brilliant at thinking and enjoy, and they love learning. And if you co-design it with them, you say to them, well, what questions should we be asking? And you get them to work in with each other and sort of almost mark each other's work and help each other out, all overseen by professionals. It works a lot better. But the big problem with education, I think, is every single person in the world thinks they're an expert because they've been through it. So any conversation about education very soon becomes autobiography. So we all think we're experts in education because we've all been to school. And that part of the problem with that is, like, we all think, well, I'm all right. Mark's all right. Tim's all right. Look at Tim's doing well. He's got his TV show and he's got his successful podcast, and, you know, and everybody likes him. He's a great chef. You know, he's done all right. He went through education. How bad can education be? Look, Tim did all right. You know, and Mark did all right. Look, he's consulting the government, so he's all right. And I had a really great example of this, you know, which is I was sat with Nick Gibb, who was the schools minister, in a meeting, and he said the problem with education in this country is the creativity agenda. It's absolutely ruined education in this country. he literally said that to me in a meeting. The creativity agenda has ruined education in this country. And you can think, well, that makes perfect sense to you because you're Nick Gibb and you're essentially an ex-lawyer who's not a very creative or engaging human being, but now you're schools minister. So clearly the education system is working because somebody like you is now partially in charge of it. So they're just going to recreate the thing they've already done. But there are examples, and increasingly examples, of schools doing things differently. School 21 is another really good example. And even in the private, in the public school sector, you know, there's quite a lot of innovation going on. Even those guys, like, you know, we've got to change the way we think about things. So people like, you know, Anthony Seldon are doing really interesting work in that space. So there is hope. And as always with these things, you know, most of it's bad. So what I spend a lot of my time doing is finding the exemplars of people who are doing it really, really well and saying, hey, look over here. Because when people can see something different, suddenly the cynicism that we're talking about goes down. People just go, oh, it's impossible. It's possible. It doesn't work. It'll never work. And then I go, yeah, well, Jeff's done it. I mean, he'll tell you it was hard. You know, it wasn't easy to do, but look, he's done it, and there it is. So don't tell me it can't be done. Why don't we help Jeff do it more, or why don't we do what Jeff did, or learn from what Jeff did and try and do it here? So it's always worth, you can spend all your time looking at everything that's wrong, or you can go and find the people who are doing it right and then bring more power to their elbow, which is a lot of my work.
Agreed. Mark, though, I am an expert on education. You said we all think we are, but I literally am. Because I've got three children and I've been through all the education system apart from faith scores. But I've been through the state education, which is my youngest one's at the moment. I've been through a bit of private education with my twins, and I've been through grammar school education. And I have to say, the biggest problem we suffer from in this country is segregation of children. Number one, that is the hugest thing, because the state schools are the ones which are missing out. All the others have it much better. And this private school education is phenomenal. And, you know, I would never send my children to private school again because I don't believe in it. But I do think I don't hate anyone who does, because you're only trying to do the best for your children, and it is much more superior. I find the idea that we have it really weird, though, really very strange, because, they, you know, I know in Finland there's lots said about the Finnish education system. I think they got rid of private education for profit. So there is some, but you don't have to make a profit out of it. And what often happens, a much smaller demographic, a much smaller population, are there. But what happens is all the people who with power and status all send their kids to the private schools over here. Suddenly, if you take them away or make them so that they're not as attractive, I mean, they're all still charitable status, which I find astonishing. But once you take them away, then all the power and all the money and all the great thinkers start going, hold on a second, we need to make all the state schools brilliant because our kids are now going to them. And so it just seems incredible that we would separate people through intelligence, finance, faith. I mean, I'm still astonished by it as a supposed to be a modern educated society that we would contemplate doing that. But let me tell you about the just very quickly in the systems. In the private schools, if your kid is not doing well, they pivot you to another private school, which looks at you to be more creative, less academic. If you are struggling, they always try and get more out of you. They really do put the care in, which you don't get in the state schools because there's so many kids and it's harder for them to do it. Though the thing you do get at state schools is you get community of all the local people, which is the thing that I love and buy into. And I think that's the most important thing in a town or a city. Anyway, I've done a whole long monologue there, but I do find it very frustrating that we segregate our children. I just don't think that's a good idea. Whilst you're segregating children, you're segregating parents as well. And the parents you're segregating means that you're not mixing everybody together because the parents and the children are all in their different camps. And school should be the center, education should be the center of communities. I thank you.
I mean, what's happening there is, again, basically we've got a consumer capitalist society which says you have the right to choose. And if you can afford to choose something else, that's an absolute right of yours. And, a consumer view of education is problematic. It should be a citizen-based view of education, which is we're all co-citizens. But actually what we're all told at the moment is you're a consumer and you can choose. And if you can afford to choose this, then you can choose that because it's better. So again, it's that kind of the whole model is based around, look after yourself and then you'll be able to choose more. But of course, those choices actually undermine quite a lot what's going on elsewhere. So we have to rethink this model of, we were subjects, now we're consumers, now we have to become citizens. We're back to our earlier conversation about if we were to design an education system as a participatory system, as a nation, how do we do that? And Finland's done it to a certain extent. So again, it can be done. And there are individual schools who have done it. And there are some very innovative thinkers in the private sector of schools going how can we partner with our local state schools to make sure that everybody, so there's good stuff going on. And I think it was Jesse Owens, the sprinter, who famously pissed off Adolf Hitler by being a black man and winning, I think, the 100 meters at the German Olympics just before the war. And I think it was Jesse who said, there's good in the world. Look for it, find it, amplify it. And I think that's probably what you do a lot of the time, Tim, which is why we love you.
just on the right to choose. The only reason you have a right to choose, you only have a right to choose if you're rich, though. In this case, which I think is a fundamental problem.
Is the fundamental problem.
That is. Well, listen, Mark, I've really thoroughly enjoyed talking to you. By the way, there's lots of good examples of how education, people are getting it right. They're turning around crap scores and stuff in your book. We do things differently, aren't there? There's examples in there where teachers, just literally staff have come in and just changed the way we think, changed the ethos of the school, and boof, it just changes around. So it can happen. It's just getting the right people, investing time, I suppose, you're investing in. Listen, Mark, thank you so much for joining me today. I've really thoroughly enjoyed it.
It's always a pleasure, Tim.